All right, welcome back to Third String Pod. I'm here with Pete Lickley. This is episode 24. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, and we're going to try to keep it short, right, Pete?
We sure are. You know, we say that every week, but this week,
this week
I think it's the week.
We really mean it. We really mean it. And, you know, we were talking about this episode, and Pete was suggesting some things to talk about. One of the things he said is that we need to get back to our roots. We need to go back to our segments. So I think that's a great idea. We should have an off-the-bench segment. Pete, do you have anything for off-the-bench this week?
Man, off-the-bench, early April. Let's talk about what happened on Monday night with one shining moment with Villanova winning the NCAA championship in convincing fashion against a really good Michigan team. Zach, I know that we were both kind of tracking on Nova as the favorite. We talked with Saul last week that they were easily the favorite in Vegas. But what are your impressions about Nova? Are they a blue blood? Is Jay Wright for real? Did Nova break the mold on how they win? What were you thinking watching this team on Monday night?
I think Jay Wright is cementing himself in the pantheon of great college basketball coaches. And I think he has the possibility now of becoming like the next Coach K. Coach K, I think, is 71 years old. He's probably going to retire soon. And I see Jay Wright as an heir apparent to the Coach K era. And I think it's an exciting time for Villanova. I think you can now count Villanova among the Blue Bloods. I think it was just on this podcast a couple weeks ago, we talked about how Villanova had historically underperformed, with the exception, the notable exception, but the exception nonetheless of their recent championship. But now, two times in 3 years, that's something that only Blue Bloods can pull off. And they did it in, like you said, very convincing fashion. So that's my first thought. I think Jay Wright's really impressive. I'd also like to point out that on this podcast, we talked about Villanova at the very beginning of the season and what a threat they were. And we also called
We also called
Villanova's first loss against Xavier way back when, before the new year. So, you know, just a little shameless self-promotion there.
For the two of us who I think have probably made, what, like 3 free throws in middle school and are probably an average height between the two of us of 5'10", we might know something about college basketball.
Honestly, I think three free throws for me might be generous. All right, so what are your thoughts on Nova?
I'm in agreement, man. I don't think it can be undersold enough that, I mean, it's March Madness for a reason, that it's all about who can get hot at the right time. The fact that Villanova was so dominant this year, I think was kind of overshadowed by UVA, to be honest, that UVA had, I would argue, probably the best defense we've seen in the last 20 years of the game, and a very, very good offense going with it. And I think dominating the ACC like UVA did, we kind of lost sight of Villanova. I think you and I talked about Villanova in late December, where we were talking about whether they could remain undefeated.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the ACC schedule kicked off. And I mean, with your favorite ACC homer over here on this side of the mic,
it was
hard not to look at UVA. And I think we really undersold Villanova for a long time. So I think Jay Wright is one of the good coaches in basketball. I've always been a fan of his. I'm pretty down on them in March normally. Like I've said, they underperform, like you and I talked about, but they were fun to watch. But you know what was interesting to watch is they had a good defense this year, but they were just an offensive powerhouse, like we saw when they made, what, 18 three-pointers and set the NCAA record in that Final Four game.
Right, and I think they set the record in the third quarter, right? I mean,
yeah,
like they shattered the previous record and broke it early on.
Yeah, they were sitting at either 13 or 14 before the end of the first half, and by
middle of the
second half, it was over in terms of that record standing. So, I'm happy for them. I think this might have been an anomaly year. It was kind of a weird year from start to finish, but the fact that it was all about the offense. I mean, Villanova had the rebounding power on the glass. It was fun to watch, but They dominated all 6 games. They won each one of them by double digits. They cleared the at least 1 point per possession in all 6 games. They just weren't challenged in this tournament, and that's just incredible over 6 games against some fantastic competition. I mean, I think aside from their 1-16 matchup, they still had tough matchups the entire way through. They beat Alabama by 25. They beat Kansas by 20. They weren't messing around all the way through. They were beyond impressive. So I'm happy for Jay Wright.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I'm a good Philadelphia Sun, Eagles fan through and through. And I pull for Philly teams when they make it. I'm not like a diehard Nova fan or anything, but I'll jump on that bandwagon. Why not?
Why not? Because we might have to talk about it later on, but some bandwagons in Philly might be in a little bit of trouble with your boy Gabe Kapler over there. But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
Well, let's pivot to baseball. This is not about the Phillies, but I have something else for off the bench. I know you saw this because we were tweeting about it back and forth, but Chance Cisco, right? Player on the Orioles catcher. He was playing for his team against the Twins. It's the ninth inning. Minnesota is ahead of Baltimore 7-0. So this is not a close game, right? They've got Jose Berrios working the mound. We've talked about Berrios. He's a bright spot on the Twins rotation this year, young ace. And Cisco comes up to bat, and he's left-handed, right? And the Twins, because he's left-handed, put on the shift. And they're, again, up seven runs. They put on the shift, so they're not playing Cisco straight up. They're, you know, playing a non-standard defensive alignment. And Cisco bunts, and he bunts and gets on base. Now, the only person to get a hit earlier in the game was, in fact, Chance Cisco. So this was his second hit in the game because the bunt fell for a hit. And the Twins afterward were really frustrated and said it was a violation of the unwritten rules of baseball. It wasn't cool. It was impolite. All of these things. And I think that's totally ridiculous. I like Brian Dozier. He's the Twins guy who was doing the most complaining about this. I like Dozier, but you can't complain about this. I mean, the object in baseball is to score runs. Well, it's to win, and to win, you have to score runs. How do you score runs? You get on base. How do you get on base? You take advantage of what you're going to be given. So if you know, guys are not playing straight up.
Hit it where they ain't, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hit it where they ain't. Exactly. So this is so ridiculous to me that the Twins are complaining about this. I say, Chance Cisco, go for it. This is great. We're not talking about a situation in which they're up seven runs and the Twins are playing him straight up and he tries to bunt. You know, I think that to me would be maybe a little more understandable if the Twins were upset about that, because everyone's just like, hey, you know, it's cold out here. We want to get the game over with. That's not what happened, though. The Twins are very, very clearly trying to minimize the run scoring environment, trying to make it as difficult as possible for Chance Cisco to get on base. So what does he do? He says, right back at you guys, you know, I'm gonna lay it down right over here where you have nobody covering third base, and I'm going to drop a bunt right down the line. And he got on base. So good for him. That's how baseball works. So I'm not sure what your thoughts are, but I was kind of irritated with the Twins for being irritated at Chance Cisco.
Yeah, you know my thoughts on the unwritten rules of baseball that we can dive into here in a second. But let me ask you one more question before I start ranting and raving about unwritten rules in baseball. If this is a 1-0 game, or if this is even a 7-6 game in the ninth and the Twins put on that shift and he bunts, is anyone upset right here?
No. No.
So it's the embarrassment that made the Twins mad.
Yeah.
That seems to be what we're getting at.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
That's preposterous. It's the same thing like in the early 2010s when Yasiel Puig was the most exciting thing in baseball and he's doing bat flips. Were they a little ridiculous? Yes. Did he bat flip when he was flying out to center field sometimes? Oh yeah, and that was hilarious. But at the same time, people are getting mad because for some reason, one of the biggest issues with our favorite sport is the fact that it can't deal with the fact that some people are having fun when it comes at the expense of someone else. It's like in the NBA, people getting mad at celebrating a dunk, or in the NFL getting mad at a sack and the 300-pound lineman is doing a dance. No other sport has issues with this. In fact, every other sport is celebrating right now when guys are trying to have fun or take advantage of something. So I'm getting really sick of these baseball unwritten rules. Not that the unwritten rules exist. I think the gentlemanly aspect of the game is actually one of the things that I really like about baseball. But at the same time, it's the fact that we then go into the locker room, go into the press conference and talk about these unwritten rules and how they're being violated and how much of an embarrassment and disrespect it is to the game. I think that's a load of baloney. I am so tired of the fact that these players keep voicing their opinions. You know what? If you're mad, don't put the shift on when you're up seven runs.
Yeah, exactly. That's my whole contention.
If you don't want Puig to bat flip, don't pitch to him. Like, it's as simple as that. Don't put yourself in a situation where someone can break this unwritten rule against you.
You know, Pete, I don't know if we've talked about the bat flip before, but I have a confession to make, and maybe you'll agree with this, but I low-key love the bat flip. I'm all about the bat flip. I love a good Jose Bautista bat flip, you know, a good strut halfway down the line to first base. Man. Like that to me is some of the most fun action you'll see in baseball. And like you said, it's even more rich when that is accompanied by a fly out to center. So I love all those moments.
Those are hilarious. You know, like
on a good walk off, yeah, you flip that bat. You know what I mean? You burn that and inject some life into the game. I remember seeing a commentary about how there's in many cases a sort of cultural collision because Latin American baseball players play much more emotionally and expressively than North American baseball players. And I think that's great. You know, I love watching players get passionate about the game. Now, I think that, you know, one of the nice things about baseball, when you talk about sort of chivalry and unwritten rules, is there are limits, I think, to the, I guess, sort of displays of confidence, we might call them. You know, you don't see aggressive smack talk like you do in football. So, you know, there are like these informal constraints placed on this, but I love a good bat flip. I think it makes the game way more fun.
Yeah, I would love to see more excitement. Like we're saying, I think some of the control and the composure makes it an even more kind of tense and interesting game to watch moment to moment. But at the same time, I mean, one of the biggest complaints that people have about the game is it's not compelling. And the reason why it's not compelling is because there's 162 games playing the dog days of summer. Each game goes for 3.5 hours at worst. And people don't feel like they can connect to this at all. If you can't connect to a 21-year-old who's hitting a walk-off, what fun is it? If he's not having fun, why am I going to pay $40 for a ticket?
Yeah,
it's
totally agree.
The sport can't complain that they're not generating interest when they are allowing their veterans to crack down on young guys because they are bunting to get on base.
Well, with
something
that,
I would like to ask, though,
go for it, really quick
before we transition, I have to get your opinion really quick just because you got me spun up on this. How do you feel about something like a bunt to take away a no-hitter? Is that okay or not?
I'm all about it. You know, the objective of the pitcher is to get every batter out. The objective of the the seven defensive players playing behind him and the catcher in front of him is to help that pitcher get that batter out. And the objective of the batter is to get on base. However you can do that, do it. Now, I think that the situation changes if the pitcher's throwing a no-hitter and the pitcher's up 9 runs. You know, it's 9-0, no-hitter, perfect game, whatever. 2 outs, a bobble on the ninth. There's a 0.0001% chance that the losing team can come back on this, right? I think if you're bunting in that situation, that's a little bit tacky. Do I have a problem with it? Not really. I mean, I just think that it's kind of a stupid thing to do because it's going to make you an enemy of everyone on that team, and I don't know why you'd want to do that. If I'm a pitcher, do I mind? I mean, I guess I haven't been a major league pitcher in that position, so I can't really say, but I would not want to think that players are going easy on me as I try to close this out. You know, I'd want to really feel like I earned it at the end, so I guess I'm sort of split on that, but I think that's a different situation. However, you know, a 1-0 game, it's been a tight game the whole way. You know, the other team has 2 hits and 1 run, and you're hitless, and you just need 1 run to go. Like, just get on base. I have no problem with that in that situation. What do you think?
I'm in agreement. I think the point you made about it being tacky, I would take it a little step further and say it's kind of bad sportsmanship, but at the same time, you play to win the game, right? So I hate to see it bottom nine when the game is clearly out of reach, and at that point, you're just trying to break up the no-hitter to break up the no-hitter because I guess it's embarrassing as a professional to get no-hit, I guess. I mean, I couldn't get a hit in baseball if my life depended on it, so what do I know about getting hits or not? But at the same time, yeah, I'm in agreement. But like usual, I kind of diverted us even after I said we'll keep it under 30 minutes. So I owe a few back to you guys.
we'll just zip through the heart of the order here, but let's pivot to that now. All right, so we are now through a week of the first baseball season. There's been a lot of great baseball action so far. Like I mentioned earlier, and you already brought this issue up, but I'm a good Philadelphia son. Growing up, loved rooting for the Phillies. The Phillies hired Gabe Kapler, who was in the front office before that, very analytically minded guy. I've heard him described by several pundits as a Chris Traeger type. So very, very high energy, a bit awkward perhaps. There are questions about how well he'll be able to sort of manage the clubhouse with that ceaseless energy when you're around professional athletes. And there was an issue earlier where he had Hobie Milner come into the game. Well, let me back up. So first of all, he's been making a name for himself by using a ton of different pitchers. In the first 2 games of the Phillies season, he set the record for most pitchers used in the first 2 games of a season. I think it was 18. Is that right, Pete? Do you remember the number?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I think it was 18 pitchers. And so Kapler... maybe it was 15, but it was a lot of pitchers, probably too many pitchers. And Kapler stands by this decision. He says it's analytically the right thing to do. And over the course of a long season, he will be vindicated. Maybe, maybe not. But he took a lot more heat a couple days ago when Hobie Milner was called in from the bullpen to come into the game. He called Hobie Milner in, and Hobie Milner had not even been warming up in the bullpen at all. So now he's potentially jeopardizing the health of his pitcher's arm by doing that. The home plate umpire let Milner have a few extra warm-up pitches. The Braves manager protested and got thrown out of the game for it. And basically everyone is questioning Gabe Kapler's competence in the wake of this. So I guess to make this a short question, Pete, are you buying or selling the Phillies' woes on this? Do you think Gabe Kapler will last through the end of the season and beyond in Philadelphia?
Yeah, so as I'm looking at this in Philadelphia, this is a tough situation because he's such a young guy who, yes, did a lot of good things in the front office of the Dodgers, which you gotta like based on what the Dodgers have done over the past few years. But I worry about him because of kind of exactly what you were talking about with how focused on the analytics game he is. And I've heard a lot of comparisons to he is the ability to kind of not necessarily re-engineer the game, but bring the same spin on it that we saw with what became so famous with Billy Beane in Oakland with Moneyball. And just the fact that this is how he's trying to tune his lineups and how he's trying to set his lineups. I was reading about what goes into him setting a lineup card. And I guess he and the coaches are sitting down and trying to plan out a lineup 10 days out and try to play all of the matchups. And obviously right now they're not dealing with the injury bug, but that'll obviously start affecting it. And right now they're trying to get everyone as many at-bats and as much exposure as they can based on the matchups, which at face value I like. But let me tell you why I'm still kind of selling on Gabe Kapler right now. I like the analytics, but what I don't like is when you're sitting your stars, who are your number three hitter, on opening day,
right,
because you want the lefty-righty matchup in a traditional left-handed hitting ballpark. Where you're just overthrowing the team chemistry more than anything else. Taking out Aaron Nola after those 68 pitches when he had a three-hit shutout in the sixth, it just, the focus on the analytics right now is overshadowing the understanding of the chemistry of the team and the flow of the game, which is something that I hope his veteran players are helping to communicate, something I think he'll come around on and start understanding more. But I think April and May are going to be pretty rough in Philadelphia as he tries to read this. You'll have to give me a better gauge on this than what I've got, but obviously the Philly media is not the friendliest of all the medias out there, but are they going to give him the time in Philadelphia if this takes him until June or July to really start hitting a good stride, try to build something and then look towards new seasons? Or could we see, I don't know, Joe Girardi sitting in Philadelphia in July because they just don't have the tolerance for this?
Yeah, I don't think we'll see that. Baseball is a long season, and it's not like Philadelphia Phillies fans are used to recent success, so I think he'll have a relatively long leash here. But I just see that everything that could go wrong for Gabe Kapler so far has, and it's really kind of unfortunate for the guy. I mean, I think he's really nice, really positive. I think he brings a lot of energy, for better or worse, to the Phillies.
Yeah.
It's interesting though that he's like this, because it's not like he's never played the game before. He played on the Tigers, Rangers, Rockies, Red Sox, even played in Asia a bit, Brewers, Rays, Dodgers. He's been around as a player, and he's really sabermetrically minded, like you said, so the Billy Beane stuff. He's been involved in Baseball Prospectus, which is the leading journal of sabermetrics. And he just, I think, has this way of managing the baseball team that doesn't connect with the players. So, you know, you're sitting your best player on opening day. I get that might make sabermetric sense for whatever his reasons are, but it doesn't make social sense, right? It's not going to foster a good clubhouse dynamics. And in fact, today, just a few hours ago, there was a report out from John Heyman of FanRag Sports and Craig Calcaterra, Yahoo Sports, that some player anonymously said that the team would be okay. The managers just needed to get out of their way. So that's, you know, trouble brewing in Philly. It seems like he's already losing the clubhouse, which is never a good sign. It's a long season. We'll see what happens. This could all become ancient history if the Phillies go on a 12-game win streak, as, you know, sometimes happens in baseball. Weird things happen. Teams get lucky. But I'd say right now it's not looking good for Gabe Kapler.
Yeah, I agree. You got to throw a lot of this on his coaching staff, though. I mean, these guys have to be understanding the fact that he's walking out to make a pitching change, and the guy who he's going to bring in is, no kidding, as evidenced on video, sitting with his feet up, still wearing a windbreaker. I mean,
right.
It's someone's got to help him out. It just feels like his coaching staff is hanging him out to dry and the players aren't buying in. So I hope this works. I really do, just because you hate to see the young guys in the game start to get a raw deal like this. But oh well. Oh well.
Yeah.
I just don't know how to read it yet. So we'll see. Yeah. We'll see.
Well, okay. Another question for you. And I'm going to try to keep this really short because we told our listeners we'd keep this short. So, all right, final question, and then we'll do some quick garbage time stuff. Cubs rotation issues. I want to talk about Shohei Ohtani. I don't think we have time today. We'll save that for next week, and I think we'll have a bigger sample size anyway. But Cubs rotation issues. So far in the season, which is obviously very short, Darvish, Quintana, Lester have all only thrown one game. But the ERAs of each of those three guys, let me read off for you, 10.38, 9, and 8.1. So those guys need to be bringing it a lot better than their first starts if they're going to carry the Cubs to the success that most people expect. Darvish made it through four innings. Quintana lasted six, but gave up a ton of runs, six runs. And then Lester was booted out after three innings. Do you buy these struggles as real? Or is this just a mirage? They're going to figure it out and the Cubs are going to be fine?
No. I'm selling this one. I think how bad this first week has gotten is not necessarily something we should disregard, because if you look at all the stats that we normally are tracking on for how good a pitcher is, whether it's ERA like you're mentioning, or we're looking at the adjusted the fielding independent pitching, excuse me, where we adjust the effectiveness at preventing the home run, walks, hit by pitches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's high too. So that's telling you that it's not just the defense is letting them down in key situations. It's just that the pitchers aren't performing. I think the Cubs, and I'm sure they won't do it, but I think if you look at all the quotes leading up to this season starting in Miami, thought that they were almost getting an injustice by how good they were, that they were having to play the Derek Jeter cannibalized Miami Marlins, who can't even field nine guys on any given day. I think they looked past the series completely. And I mean, things have still not gone great since they left Miami, but I think they looked past it. They had a lot of things on their mind. They've heard all the hype that jokers like me have been saying, where if the Cubs aren't in the NLCS and the World Series, this is the letdown of the century. I think they look past it. I'm selling that this rotation's in trouble, but I am buying that there is some inconsistency and some mental blocks right now on the north side of Chicago that Joe Maddon is going to have to figure out here real soon, that he has the same basic team that he's had for the past couple of years, with obviously a couple additions, subtractions here and there. But the expectations on this club, I actually think are higher than they were last year coming off a World Series win. I think because they didn't win the World Series last year, because they turned it on so strong in the second half, I think the expectations are probably in the back of their minds right now, and they're struggling with that. How about you?
Yeah, I think your take is about right. It's very difficult to overreact to one start, and all of those guys have had one start. So I'm not willing to say that they're, you know, in total decline and the Cubs staff is a mess. Not at all. I think the Cubs are going to be just fine. I think this has zero implications for the Cubs' regular season, the Cubs' chances of winning the NL Central, which I think they will. Although I'm excited to see the Cubs-Brewers series coming up here. I think
absolutely.
I think that'll be revealing. But these guys will figure it out. I'm not worried about that at all. What I do think this is concerning for is the Cubs' postseason chances, because these pitchers are clearly not the lights-out pitchers that they once were in their career. Lester in his age 34 season, Darvish is 31. Even Quintana, who used to be a young fireballer, getting up there, he's 29. So I think these guys, you know, it's becoming more clear these guys have the best years behind them. And as pitchers get older, they generally start slower. I mean, people are worried about Clayton Kershaw, who did not have a good start, his first start of the season. Now, I think he'll be fine. I think these guys will figure it out. They'll figure out how to be, you know, pull the CC Sabathia. They lose velocity and get more crafty with where and how they throw the ball. So they'll figure it out. But I think this does pose potential problems for the Cubs' postseason chances, especially if they're going up against a rotation that has, for example, Lance McCullers and Dallas Keuchel and Justin Verlander and Garrett Cole. So, this is a mirage, but there's some underlying truth, I guess, is where I'd settle.
Don't forget how much the Cubs offense is letting them down right now.
Yeah, that's a great point.
They're hitting .204. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to be at the top of the NL Central hitting .204. I mean, maybe, nope, I'm not even going to pick another division where you're going to be competitive at 204. And so it's across the board. And actually, that's the indicator to me that it's not as bad. If they were still hitting 6-7 or putting up 6-7 runs a game and the pitching couldn't sustain it, I'd be a little more worried. But it's just across the board. They're flat right now.
Yeah, and I think this will recover. I mean, Anthony Rizzo right now is at 50 WRC+. Plus. Average is 100, so that's bad. Ian Happ, 46. Jason Hayward, 46. Javier Baez has a WRC plus of 12. 12. Yeah. That's not a typo. So
not great.
They'll recover. You know, I'm not worried about them. Tommy La Stella is not going to have a WRC plus of 237 all year. That's not sustainable for Tommy La Stella. They'll figure it out. This stuff will all sort out. You know, we can't overreact, but I do think the Cubs are not the Astros of the National League.
Fair.
I think that we should probably start wrapping this up, Pete. So you want to move
Let's
on?
Let's do it.
Garbage time?
Yeah, man. What's on your mind?
So I think we should just talk a little bit of football here. Some NFL transactions. We have the Patriots shipping off Brandon Cooks to the Rams. And the Rams now having added Aqib Talib in free agency to their secondary. Added Sue from the Dolphins. The Dolphins released Sue in free agency. They didn't want to pay him that massive contract. And the Rams signed him to a one-year deal. I think the Rams are getting ready to contend. They're making a strong statement. I heard Mike Lombardi saying this is, you know, putting butts in seats in Los Angeles there, but I think they're thinking much more ambitiously than that. I think they had a great season this year. People were talking about the Rams as Super Bowl contenders, and I think they could have been if Sean McVay had game planned better for the Falcons. So I think the Rams are seeing they have a window here. They have a bright, offensively minded coach, a guy who understands his players. And I think they're thinking that this could be the year that they make a serious run. I think they are becoming the team to beat in the National League. What do you think?
I completely agree. I think it's worth noting that this was still a good deal for the Patriots as well. But let's start with the Rams and with Sean McVay.
By the way, I realized I just said National League, still stuck in the baseball mode. NFC is what I meant. The N conference, yeah.
Same difference. Right. Same difference. there's at least 50 people right now cringing at that. That I said same difference, so sorry about that one, guys. But Sean McVay's ability to understand and tweak offenses like we first saw in Washington with Kirk Cousins and then what we saw last year out there taking Jared Goff, who had basically been written off by Jeff Fisher before, I think that this team offensively is really going to be the team to beat. I still don't really buy that defense is going to be as good as people are starting to say it will be with the addition of Aqib Talib. He's fantastic. Let's not beat around the bush. He's fantastic, but he's one guy, and he's getting older, and while he didn't necessarily have a down year in Denver this past year, I don't think he's nearly the dominant guy that he was probably the last two or three years that Peyton was the quarterback there in Denver, to give you guys some time reference. So I think the offense is well on its way in Los Angeles. I don't think the defense is where it needs to be. So I'm still buying them as an NFC championship contender. I'm not putting them in the Super Bowl yet, but we'll see what they do in the draft. I mean, the draft has that incredibly high ceiling and incredibly low floor for who you can pick up. It'll be interesting. But speaking of the draft,
I've got one quick retort to that. So
yeah.
tell me if these four names change your mind, realizing that these guys are all playing on the same side of the ball for the same team. Ndamukong Suh.
Okay.
Aaron Donald.
Okay.
Aqib Talib.
Yep.
And Marcus Peters.
Because
to me, you have Peters and Talib anchoring a very strong, well, not very strong, providing a very strong anchor for a secondary. And then you have Sue and Donald to win in the trenches. And I think Donald's probably the best defensive tackle in the NFL. And Sue used to be. He's got that upside to him still. I think he's getting a little bit older. But to have those two guys in the same line, I think is formidable. And then you've seriously boosted your secondary with Peters and Talib. I mean, I think they've really upgraded their defense in a big way. And then they add Cooks to the other side.
I don't think the upside on Ndamukong Suh is nearly what it used to be. I think between the disciplinary issues, so there's such a close eye on him, and also some of the recent injury issues and just seemingly mental lapses in terms of getting himself ready for a game week in and week out.
Yeah.
I don't really buy that he is that dominant guy that we knew in Miami as he was like stepping on people all the time.
Right.
So I think you make some great points that there are some improvements. I also disagree with you a little on the defensive tackle. Probably a better debate for us here in a couple weeks. I'm going to stick to NFC Championship, though, which still a great season, especially for a young Sean McVay. But yeah, I don't think they're quite there. I think their offense is fantastic,
though. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Speaking of New England, just really, really quick, because we have to talk about the evil empire. Bill Belichick always trades guys a year before he thinks they're done.
Right.
Brandon Cooks was going to get paid very handsomely if he stayed in New England. New England doesn't have the money to pay him based on what they're looking at. If Gronk is indeed coming back, keeping Tom Brady around, Julian Edelman's still there. I mean, they still have a lot of big bills to pay. So Bill Belichick dumps a little talent in a trade that helps the Rams out a lot. But now, looking at the draft in New England, he's got 2 first-round picks, 2 second-round picks, a 3rd-round pick, and 3 picks on Saturday. Now, I think they need some offensive line rebuilding. They've got some offensive line rebuilding. I think it's probably time they go after a quarterback who they're not going to trade to the 49ers in the middle of the night because of drama. But I think they're going to have some big contracts. So I think this was a great move by Bill Belichick to ensure that he is going to have something that exists here in 3 years if he's in fact still coaching the team.
So, yeah. So, I mean, there's talk of the Patriots trading both of their first round picks to the Giants for Odell Beckham Jr. That's absurd. That will never happen.
Agreed.
What do you think they could do with those first two round pick, those 2 first-round picks? Do you think it's possible that they could package those 2 first-rounders in a deal to trade up in the first round and go get their quarterback of the future?
Yes. Yes. And I think teams like we talked about a couple weeks ago when the Colts were making all their moves, I think the Colts are still looking to trade that 6th-round pick away. I'm sorry, that number 6 pick away and fall a little lower in the draft in order to try to beef up a very, very bad offensive line and a very weak secondary. I think you got a lot of teams right now who don't need the quarterback of the future as much as they need to kind of build a core. So I think this is ripe for New England to get into the top 7 or 8 of the draft this year.
Yeah, I think you're right. So the Buccaneers are at 7 right now. They need running back, cornerback, defensive lineman, safety. Those generally are positions you can get later in the first round. Bears, similar position. They need a corner, offensive lineman, edge rusher, defensive line help.
And they certainly don't need a quarterback after all the moves they've made recently.
Right. So, I mean, the Buccaneers got Winston a couple years ago, and the Bears already got Trubisky. So they're not going to be looking to draft a quarterback. I think it's possible the Patriots go up there, and then they'll get Lamar Jackson. I think Lamar Jackson's flown under the radar, but he's a very very good player, very athletic player. I'm not quite as sold on his ability as a pure passer, but I think he's athletic enough to learn that. I think, you know, Deshaun Watson is a good comp for him, potentially Vic, maybe with a little bit less arm strength. Certainly better than your Johnny Manziels, and I would say better than Baker Mayfield for sure. I think,
yeah,
you know, if Lamar Jackson goes to the Patriots because everyone else is sleeping on Lamar Jackson and then he goes on to have a Hall of Fame career, it's going to be frustrating. It's going to be frustrating to know that everyone passed on him and Bill Belichick got him.
What about if somehow a dude like Josh Allen falls outside of the top 4? I mean, doesn't he fit that Bill Belichick system so well, this dude coming out of Wyoming? I mean, it's just, I think there's a lot of options for them, and they are just continuing to make themselves ready more than any other team we talk about in the NFL. We joke about how bad the Redskins front office is. The Patriots are the exact opposite of them in every single way. They seem to anticipate their needs better than any other team in the NFL.
Right. Yeah. I think you're right. Definitely. I mean, I've seen some mock drafts with Josh Allen going number 1 to the Browns now because he had a great pro day. People are saying, you know, freakish athlete, all that stuff. I honestly don't see it there with Josh Allen. I don't, you know, when I watch his tape, I see him maybe as the type of player who could develop for a couple years under Brady and learn the system from Belichick, just like Garoppolo did. So yeah, that's an intriguing thought.
The dumbest move the Browns can make is drafting a quarterback this year. They're not going to win the Super Bowl this year, but you just made a great deal to get Tyrod Taylor in, a true leader in the locker room, who's also demonstrated his ability to take awful franchises and make them into something with what he did with the Bills after the Bills screwed him over so badly this past year. So going after a quarterback, 1, slap in the face, 2, another waste of a good draft pick. They need to go out there and get some dudes who they can build a franchise around.
Yeah, I agree. If I'm the GM of the Browns, this is what I do. I call the Patriots, see if they're willing to deal for that number 4. I make a deal to basically get another bevy of picks, including the two first, maybe the two first rounders that New England has and one of their second rounders, maybe throw in a fourth or something. So trade down. And then I draft Saquon Barkley at number one. And then I use that bevy of remaining picks to just build my entire roster. And then next year I go get my quarterback of the future and we start contending at that point.
Yeah. I like it. Sign you up. Yeah. Give you a contract.
Let's do it. Come on. Give us a call, Cleveland. We'll go over on the team for you.
Come on. I've watched Draft Day at least 10 times.
All right, Pete. That's all I had for garbage time. And that's all I've got for today. You have anything before we close out?
Real quick, something I'm tracking on that we don't talk about too often on the pod.
Yeah.
NHL playoffs start next week. Obviously, you guys know I'm a DC sports fan, Homer, so I'm rooting for my Caps. But
the Golden Knights, of course. Yes. Yeah. You got to go for the Golden Knights.
51-22-7, best record as an expansion team in the modern expansion era. They don't really have the star power to make a true Stanley Cup run, in my humble opinion, this year. But they're going to do something in the playoffs. That'll be fun to watch. And here's your funny story for the day. For all of you guys who might be driving to work or doing errands this weekend as you're listening to Third String, Nashville Predators got kind of a raw deal on a called back goal earlier this week where the NHL replay officials, not the guys on the ice, the NHL replay officials, called back the goal, cost the Preds the game. The Preds are in contention. Their fans lost their minds. And it became obvious in no better way than one Nashville Predator fan yesterday mailing two dead catfish from Nashville in a USPS in Nashville after coordinating with Canadian Customs to make sure that she could send two dead catfish to NHL headquarters with the phrase, "You suck," written on them. So not only did she go through all this work, it cost her $200 to tell the NHL headquarters that they suck and that her Predators are for real. So,
oh my goodness.
Here's to you, Nashville, for spending a lot of money when you're already in contention.
I love passionate sports fans. I love it. We didn't talk at all about Kyrie Irving's knee, but he's done for the season. That's just a crushing blow to the Celtics and crushing blow to my level of enjoyment for watching the Celtics play. So we can maybe dissect that a little bit more next time. There's a lot more to talk about, a lot more baseball going on, and we'll be watching a lot of those games, and we'll have a lot more to talk about. We still got to talk about Shohei Ohtani. Until then, thanks for listening to Third String Pod. You can follow me on Twitter at Zach Crippen. You can follow Pete at Pete LaCleed. Until next time, thanks for listening to Third String Podcast.